Yeah, we lived on 65th Street, and there's a little called Harvard's playground just about two blocks from where we lived. And I understood that they were going to have four Nazi speakers. One was Prince von Ruprecht, and one was Hermann Schwinn. We called him Hermann Schwein. And I'd heard him at the forum. And the two other, I've forgotten why, but four of them were going to speak there. And there was no one to expose them and everything. So I called the Jewish anti-Nazi league. I said, you've got to send a speaker. You've got to send a speaker to oppose them and to expose them and everything. We haven't got one. I said, you've got to find one. And I belonged to the anti-fascist league, you know. That's where he's already at one time belonged. That's the only time I ever met him. You know, after he wrote that I was worse than Dorothy and everything. And so finally, then I went to see another Sylvia Wexler who belonged to the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League. I said, Sylvia, no matter what, you've got to get a speaker there. So finally they sent a Duco speaker. I wish I could remember his name. He was a wonderful speaker, dynamic and knowledgeable. Hugh Macbeth, I don't know whether it is a Belgian or not. They sent him to speak because they had no one else. And when they got up to this Nazi gang, they said that when all this is just put up by the Jews as a thing, no Jew is being there except the bad Jews. Now, no one, you know, who's a good Jew is, you know, and everything. And after all, they were living... you know, Hitler had given jobs where millions had been out of work, all the things that they were thinking. So, you know, he got a lot of applause. They got a lot of applause. Then Macbeth, he took Macbeth, and I'll never forget it, got up and said, you know, my father was a slave, and he had enough to eat, and they did provide shelter because that's the way the slaves worked. But who wants to be a slave in order to have enough to eat? And he went on to tell what the Nazis were really doing. But is this what you want? Is this what? And these people here who are telling these things, who are telling lies and everything, he was just magnificent. And the American Legion was the one who was sponsoring the meeting, you know, and said, but the American Legion, they're not all, you see, some of them are really befuddled. And they put it to a vote when the whole speaking was over. Who do you support, Hugh Macbeth or these speakers? The only ones who supported the Nazis were the Nazis themselves, no one else. But the whole thing, there were 300 people there, went solidly for Hugh Macbeth and everything. Then I spoke to some of the policemen who were also there. And I said, you see, I know you are here, you see, to protect. Whom do we call on that we're in trouble upon you? But you know, you have to have facts. How can your sympathy and everything? Now, you heard one side of it now, and that side and everything. He said, you see, the trouble is they don't tell us the facts. They tell us, you know, each one with his influence. But you're right, absolutely. I'm absolutely opposed to what Hitler is doing. Absolutely opposed to it. And then it came out in the newspapers too how Hugh Macbeth had put to flight these things.
What year was that, Barbara?
That must have been 19. As I remembered, I think it was about 1935, just before the trials began to take place in the Soviet Union. And but you see, when things are done, and then if someone does something about it. But I'll never forget that, when the human death came and spoke. Now he's dead now, but his son is a lawyer just like himself.
Was most of your activity right after you came to Los Angeles related to the Anti-Fascist League then?
Yes. Yes, it was. See, even when, because by the time when I went back into the 1930s, Carol June was 11 years old already, you know, so, you know, I could have... But some of the things, you see, although I did speak up against, but still I really did think that a person who didn't know anything about socialism, who wasn't a socialist or a communist, really was an ignorant person. I really think if they didn't have a Marxist understanding of society, they were ignorant. Oh, you know, we did swallow them off a lot. And when I think that I, who did speak up, was sometimes critical of the, and severely criticized for it, but never, never was I expelled, never was anyone ever brought charges against me.
Were you ever threatened with expulsion for speaking up?
I was only once threatened with having to be brought up on charges, and that was by a young woman who was, went to college with my daughter, with Carol Jean, Eileen, who was she was just about a year older than Carol Jean, so at that time she couldn't have been more than about 22 or 23. And she said that, because she's the one that told me that the party had said they wanted me to teach, you know, and when I said, no, I wouldn't do it, she said, you know, if I didn't know your background, if I didn't know something about you, I'd bring you up on charges. I said, don't be so liberal and anything. I said, bring me up on charges. I said, I don't care, because I won't do anything that I just don't believe in. And she said, would you appear? Yes, you would appear. She directly was in jail at that time, and then told her that I was going to be brought up on charges, someone I don't know who. And she was just horrified, terrified. I'd be brought up on charges.
She was in jail already under the Smith Act?
Yes. So, you know, that was about 1950, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. 1950.
So the party line at that point was still black, self-determination for blacks then, as late as that?
Yes.
Actually began in the mid-30s.
Yes, it went down. See, this was in 1950, sure. Yes, it went down. And you see, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was really a fine person, she had been a wobbly and a very magnificent one, and then she became a communist poet. And she was a friend of Browder, wrote a book about the man from Kansas when he was in jail and everything. I liked her very, very much, you know, because she had a lot of common sense, too. But nevertheless, she learned that you don't ever be critical. Ellery Brewer said, we'll tolerate anything except criticism of the Soviet Union. Ellery Brewer, I knew her real well. No.
Barbara, how did you feel, for instance, when Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, after Browder was, before he was expelled, when the line became to dump Browder, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was among those who then denounced him?
Yes.
How did you feel about that kind of shifting back and forth?
You see, I didn't like it, and I knew that the pressure was brought on her, but when I mentioned it, they said, well, look, all right, so a person has changed, you said. Because he has changed. I said, but he was a whole lot better than Foster. He was a better speaker and he knew more than Foster. I never thought Foster was very much of a speaker and everything. So, you know, they explained things away in such a way, and then look, the Soviet Union is under attack. Now the whole thing, the most important thing is to counter the defense of the Soviet Union. Nothing but nothing must stand before that. That's the most important thing. Look what these people have suffered, and they have terribly. Look how they were decimated, and they were. So, you know, you began to feel that kind of a feeling that you had to, and that you shouldn't be so. And when I remember one comrade who said to me, you know, Barbara, you do a lot of nitpicking. I said, why? He said, because these are not important things that you take issue with. They're not there, all right? I grant you, they're not there, but they're not important enough. The important thing now is to support the Soviet Union. That takes precedence over everything. And you see, how could Stalin couldn't have gotten away with all that, except you support this. You can't, they're not criticized because you're joining the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You're helping the enemy. You're talking the same words as the enemy and everything.
Did you come to feel or believe that, or was it just the tremendous pressure that was?
Well, it was the tremendous pressure that I felt that, you know, that without my wanting to, I would be helping the enemy, you know, and everything.
Well,
so.
Barbara, why don't we backtrack? Because this is getting into some of what I wanted to cover today. In fact, when we finished last time, we were talking about when you first came to Los Angeles. So until you rejoined the party in 36, what were the main activities? Were you
the main activities were, see, I was a member of the anti-Nazi league, not the Hollywood anti-Nazi league, which were mostly Jewish, mm-hmm. but the other one, and some of the leaders of that were really very, very wonderful people. I told you about the leader of it, who was a wonderful woman and really highly knowledgeable. Her son was killed at Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. and that destroyed her. From that time on, she didn't talk to anybody. She went to San Bernardino and just died.
Mm.
Because but she was a powerful speaker at the forums and everything. She was one of the heads of they changed something then for peace and freedom, and then first to the against war and fascism. Mm-hmm. And I was a member of all three of them, you know.
Well, they shifted from the American League against
war and fascism,
and then for American League for Peace and Freedom.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, was the anti-Nazi League separate from
the anti-Nazi League? Yes, the Hollywood anti-Nazi League was mainly against Hitler, and most of them were Jewish, mm-hmm. you know, especially in Hollywood there, you know.
Now,
they did a tremendous job. They did a tremendous job, but the American League Against War and Fascism and the American League for Peace and Freedom was really much more widespread and covered a much greater line than just that, you know,
mm.
because they fought against the oppression all over, you know, and the anti-Nazi League was mainly against Hitler.
So all of these would be in the early, 33 to 35
into
there?
Yes. Well, in 33, Hitler came, so it really didn't start the real fight against him until about 35
mm-hmm.
and everything. And they were very active at that time. But my activities were mainly in the League Against War and Fascism, then in the League for Peace and Freedom. Mm-hmm. And the ILD.
And what in the anti-fascist league? What was the main activity? Putting on these forums, was that it?
Well, that was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do anything, but it was one of them. And then they were able to attract a great deal of the intellectuals mm-hmm. on campuses and everything. You'd be surprised how many they did, and even many of the professors, you know, because there was always the Un-American Committee, you know, who was there and everything, and here too. But nevertheless, American League Against War and Fascism and the American League for Peace and Freedom attracted a great deal, and it was widely attended. And I think they were very, very effective in many respects.
And now it was also involved in support of the loyalist cause in Spain first.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely, wholeheartedly, and everything, running bazaars and running sales to help them, and then the picket lines, you know, and everything.
Where would the picket lines be?
The picket lines were at the embassies.
Mm-hmm. And then you were active primarily in that, and then continued with the ILD still?
Yes.
Well, what was your ILD activity like here in Los Angeles?
Well, in every way that I can think of, they supported the American League Against War and Fascism and the League for Peace and Freedom, you know. It's a sad thing that these organizations that were so fruitful, just like the ILD, folded. And I Dorothy said other organizations to displace her, like the one for justice and everything. I don't think anything ever took the place of the of these themselves.
Was the membership the same essentially in the ILD and in the Anti-Fascist League?
No. In the Anti-Nazi League, most of them were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Not all, you know, because they were supported. Macbeth came from the Anti-Nazi League, but mainly it was, and was confined more to Hollywood than anywhere else. Whereas the American League Against War and Fascism and the League for Peace and Freedom was pretty wide spread all over.
And that was not predominantly CP members?
No, no. It was predominantly, though, really students and college people, or people who really did. They're more students than, you know. That's true. And they did conduct forums.
Mm-hmm.
And they, many times, people at the schools, I remember my Carol Jean that I told you, spoke to her teachers and told them about them and got their support.
Well, Barbara, what were some of the ILD campaigns that you worked on here in Los Angeles? Do you recall?
Well, one of the things that we worked, all of us worked on, was the Tom Mooney thing, you know. Everyone worked on the Tom Mooney thing. By the way, I got to know Tom Mooney real well. I met him many times. Francis Ruth went almost every day when he was in San Francisco. And Tom Mooney told me many, many things that had gone on. But, you know, the nicer one of the two was Billings.
That's what I've heard.
Yes, Billings was a lovely guy. But I never met him. But we supported him in every way we could and wrote to him and everything.
Well, how did you get into the prison, in fact?
How did we get in? Mooney was at San Quentin, we had a committee that once a week there was a group. Different ones went to San Quentin. That's where I first met Frank Spector. He was on the, he had been arrested because he fought against them in the Imperial Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I first met Frank Spector, and he was about 30 years old then. That was an awful long time. It was in the 30s, you know.
So each of you would go, how often would you go to the prison?
We would go every week.
And it was
always see a different one.
I see.
I told you the funny thing that happened, that when this friend of mine picked up a woman who was coming into California. She had just bought herself a car, and she was interested in Tom Mooney because he was a celebrated case. And we've been great friends, you know. And so she came along with our group. I didn't realize she really did very little of it, but it was a kind of a romantic interest, she felt, but she wanted to meet Tom Mooney. Well, when we came to San Quentin, Tom Mooney was sick, so she couldn't, so we saw Matthew Schmitz. Well, you know, Matthew Schmitz was a very clever guy. I think he had one eye.
Mm.
I don't remember too well. So she asked him, what are you in here for? And he looked at her. I had seen him before, so he knew that I knew. He looked at her rather surprised. Well, he said, I'm accused of murder. Murder, she said. Murder? Did you do it? Did you do it? He said, well, perhaps I did. She said, oh, my. Why did you do it? He said, well, they were against the Union, and they were killing us, too. Oh, then it was self-defense. Oh, it was always self-defense, he said, of course. We would never attack anybody. But it was really funny, you know. I don't think she ever really got to understand, but she was a lovely woman. She gave money. She gave money for these causes, you know.
Well, Barbara, was this visiting group all connected with the ILD, or was it the Tom Mooney Defense Committee?
No, I think it was the ILD. Defense Committee.
Well,
but we supported them, we helped them.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't, but it was just from the ILD that we went to. And we had this committee every week. They went to see always a different person. I met McNamara. You never met anyone as sweet and kind and gentle. And when I asked McNamara, see, that was before I even understood what Darrow had done, because I adored Darrow, but that was a terrible mistake he made to have him plead guilty. That would have destroyed Harriman. Yeah. He would have been elected socialist mayor of Los Angeles. So I said to McNamara, James McNamara, I didn't meet the other brother, I said, Jim, aren't you really sorry you did? He said, if looking back, you know, if you could have done the, yes, it was a very big mistake. It was a very big mistake. He said, the whole thing was a mistake. The whole thing, going bombing the Times wasn't going to really bother anyhow, you know. See, Adamick then wrote a book called Dynamite. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, that's the stuff. And by the way, when Bernard was hitchhiking from Los Angeles to back to Berkeley where we lived, Adamick, when he hitched a ride, Adamick is the one who had a new car and picked him up. And they became very, very friendly. And Bernard said he was a very, very kind, but he committed suicide, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, he did. And
Well, but so you met and visited with Schmidt and McNamara and Mooney.
And thanks, Dexter. And everything. But we went every week and everything.
Well, you got to know them fairly well then.
I got to know them pretty well, yes. Now, you know, Schmidt was a highly intelligent guy and a wonderful engineer. They trusted him. They let him get out and go to Los Angeles because he did work for them, you know. He would measure out and tell them what had to be done because he was almost an architect, self-taught. But he was really a very, very clever mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed him, you know, so they did. And the nicest one of them all that I met was McNamara.
Mm. Did you notice his letters
Yes. Schmidt, too, and
yes.
Schmidt was, see, when I saw him, he was already older, you know, and was already getting bald. But here, he's so handsome and everything. But he was a very knowledgeable man, you know, very, very brilliant man.
I've talked to several people who would go over and see Mooney, and they all... None of them really liked him. They thought that he was not a nice person.
They thought he was arrogant and he didn't But then I knew him. I never saw that arrogance in him, you know. He told us about his wife. He said she had been a wonderful woman, but some of the labor leaders really got her to drinking and she became a lush. And my daughter's mother-in-law, who was on the Mooney Committee and knew Mooney real well, you know, and knew Rena real well. She said everything that Tom Mooney said about Rena was a lie. So Rena was just one of the finest persons she ever met, and she gave her whole life to working for his defense.
Well, at one point, didn't he get involved in accusing the ILD of taking the money from that was being sent in for his defense and not giving it to the Mooney Committee?
Well, I know there were some accusations, but I never knew how well-founded they were. I really never found out that, you know, because I didn't think from my knowledge of him that he would do a thing like that. From all I knew of him, he was really a rather principled guy, but he wasn't a pleasant guy. He was someone would ask him a question, and he says, how do I know that was a dumb question or something. He wasn't very, he wasn't a very good, let's say he wasn't very subtle.
Well, Barbara, during this time, this is when you were still up north, that you were with
him. Yes.
I
saw him after we came to Los Angeles, because the woman, Martha Ayers, who was commissioned to make a bust of him, and she made a bust, and afterward they sold that little one of it for $1 each, you know, to raise money for Mooney. I went with her to San Francisco because my daughter was living there, you know. And Martha now is one of the famous sculptresses in the world. And she's a marvelous woman. Now she's in one of those homes because She went blind.
Mm-hmm.
But and her son James is he was in the party at one time, her husband too. And all her children were in the Young Communist League. So she spoke to Tom Mooney, and once I went with her, then she spoke to him, you know. Every afternoon for 1 hour, they just sat in the prison.
The prison authority seemed to have been fairly open to all of this coming and going.
Oh, yes, we could all go. We had no trouble. And in the prison, many of them, the guards and everything, who knew Tom intimately, Tom was allowed to walk around in San Francisco and everything. People didn't know it, but that's true. He could go anywhere he pleased, you know.
Well, Barbara, when you were still up north, in the late 20s, Kate Richards O'Hare then moved to California, to San Francisco, I understand. Did you ever have contact with her again?
No, I never. Whenever she spoke, it was just when I couldn't go, but I really adored her.
Because she remained a member of the Socialist Party.
Yes, she never joined the Communist Party that I know of.
But so you never had contact
but she
with
was
her again?
No, I would have liked to. But at that time, too, they frowned upon it, you know, too, and everything.
Because she wasn't a member of the Communist Party?
They never attacked her. Mm-hmm. No one ever attacked her because she's a hero. But neither did they sponsor her very much.
So when you came down here, then you continued with the ILD work, which was mainly on the Mooney.
The Mooney or any of the prisoners. So there's a lot of other people thrown into jail. For one thing, we were very active at that time where they were putting people out of their homes, you know, or that they wouldn't rent to Negroes and that, you know, and we would go ahead and pick at those homes, you know, and protect them. Or, you know, when they go went ahead and people threw people's furniture out, we went and put the furniture back in.
This is as part of the ILD?
That's right, part of the ILD and also of the Unemployed Council.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you. You did work with the Unemployed Council,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, yes.
And they're the ones...
Dorothy was one of the heads of the Unemployed Council, but I just carried out all of this, whatever. And we had a picket line over, and we called for a group to go ahead and do it, then I went.
Mm-hmm. But that's what was the Unemployed Council where you would put the furniture back
yes,
in.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And wasn't the Scottsboro Boys case was when you were in Los Angeles already, too, was it?
Yes.
Well, wasn't there a fight between the CP and the NAACP over the handling of the Scottsboro case and the... There seems to be a fight which involved, because the ILD and the NAACP were cooperating, weren't they, on the...
Well, case? You see, even the Angela Hungen case, there was some disagreement about it, but we never knew too much about it. They never came out, you know, and really told us of the differences they had or anything. You just only were assigned to certain things and not the other things. But you never really knew all the things that were going on, the differences and everything. You never knew very much about it. They didn't put it in cold print, you know. Or if they did, it was in such a way that they never antagonized anyone too much.
Mm-hmm.
But if you did, went against what was prescribed, then, you know, they came down on you with discipline, they called it. I remember one case of their damn discipline, a woman who now, her mother had been a communist even in Czechoslovakia when it was still Bohemia, but they were socialists. And so Anne Colgen, at one time, she was only 24 years old when I first met her, and I was already at that time in my 50s and everything. We became very close friends, you know. And I always went to speak for independent teachers. I was the spokesman. Very few people got to speak there because they didn't allow it. They didn't want it. And one of the heads in Los Angeles, I made friends with Mrs. Eckerson. She was one of the heads in Los Angeles. And very sympathetic, and we became very close friends, and I just loved her. And she said, Barbara, the head of the parent teachers is in Washington. And they're a conservative group. Make no mistake about that. They don't permit speakers from the floor, nor questions or anything. But the only way, she said, you're not afraid of them. Get up and speak if you've got something to say. She said, can you do it? I said, I think I can. Because I felt so close about, what do you think it was about the anti-wall? That wall was threatening and everything, and I felt so strong about that that I would have yielded the lion in his den for that. I said, well, what else do I do, Mrs. Eckerson? And she gave me a lot of pointers about the parent teachers that I could do and what I could get away with. She said, you'll find out if you do it, you'll get a lot of sympathy and support. And believe me, parent teachers also have their ears very close to the ground. If there's a threat against their discipline, they'll loosen up. So I never can forget her. You know, you meet all kinds of people, Mary. So I remember at that time I went with Anchorage to see the principal of the Horace Mann School. Carol June was already at Horace Mann. And I said, Mr. Richter, you are a father as well as a principal. You know what war is intending. It's already in the late 30s with Hitler and everything. You've got to speak up in the parent teachers. After all, what are the parent teachers for if we do not speak up? He says, look, you know, I'm supposed to be the head of the parent teachers in Italy, but it's, you know, it's only an honorary position. I really have no influence. And let me tell you something. I have sons. I'm as opposed to war as you are, but I also have to have a position. I can't speak up too strong. At that time, Spain was going on. That was the thing, you know, that, oh, you can't even imagine how strong was the support for Spain, you know, amongst the radicals. So I said, well, I told her that Mrs. Eckerson had told me. I said, now I intend to bring it up on the floor of the parent teachers. He said, I'll give you all the support I can, but don't ask me to do it because I have to have the job. And, you know, believe me, you're supposed to have tenure, but tenure can be there also, you know, against all this that goes on. And so when we came to the meeting, so Anne Trojan came with me to see how you do it, you know. After all, I've been in it for so many years. So when I got up and she said, well, you don't have anything. I know you don't have any, but it's a time I said that you did have. This will affect our lives. Every one of us have, if we don't have grown-up sons, then we have brothers or fathers and everything. And it's about time we discuss those things. And that's why we're parent teachers. I am a parent, and therefore I think we should work together. Because the teachers only have the children for a short time, we have the difference all the time. And I think we should discuss these things that are going on that might lead to war. And our sons might have to die, our fathers, our brothers. So we should discuss it. And I don't think that the things that come down from Washington can forbid us to exercise our rights as both as citizens and as members of the parent teachers. Well, to their surprise, I got a lot of applause with that. And she says, well, then, what do you want us to do? She instead of saying, well, we don't permit it. That's what they had been doing. We don't permit it. Sit down. But I want us to go ahead and have a plan of action of what we can do to discuss, to bring it out in the open, what is going to happen and everything. Now, Anne Trojan, who thought Dorothy was the most wonderful person in the world, you know what she said to me? She said, it's about time that Dorothy was put out to pasture. I said, Anne, you're not only ignorant and uncultured, but you're crude. You're crude and I can't even express the thing for you, but you're just a crude, uneducated. Well, I've known peasants who know a whole lot more than you do. You know, Anne, just to be a devout follower doesn't show anything because you're only loyal to an idea, but you don't know anything about what's going on in the name of that idea. She says, but I don't think we should stand with the enemy of the Soviet Union. If you criticize them, you're doing just what they're doing. I says, oh no, we're doing it as friends, constructively. They're doing this to attack. We're doing it to, because I think when they do these things in the Soviet Union, they lay themselves open to ridicule. It's ridiculous for them to refuse to allow anyone to write or to question anything. If you don't have a discussion, that's the thing that you feel always good for discussion. To put a person in jail because they want to discuss a thing, because they don't understand why this is done, this is really silly. That's going back to the temple and the synagogue and everything. So she said, but I still don't think you have to have... I said, look, there's a very big difference between constructive criticism or discussion and attacking. I'm not attacking. I think the Soviet Revolution was the greatest thing that ever happened. The first great thing that was a direct threat to capitalism. I think it's one of the greatest things that ever happened. That doesn't mean that I have to think that every leader is one of the greatest people that ever... I do think Lenin is a great leader and everything, but I don't think she... I said, when Lenin said, every kitchenmaid must be able to run the state, he didn't mean that every kitchenmaid has to read this cup of pie, but it does mean that every kitchenmaid has to know what's going on. How can you support or be critical of something if you don't know what it is? If you don't dare to question why, there's not the part but to reason why, there's but to accept or die. You couldn't know.
Barbara, when was this, what was it that started the argument between you? Your criticism of what?
Of the Soviet Union going into Czechoslovakia.
You mean more recently?
That's right.
I see.
That's when it started.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were talking about now in the 30s or... No, this was the Czechoslovakia.
That's right. This was Czechoslovakia. Well, thing that split the public.
Yeah. Now, what happened, though, in the 30s? Here you were, like, at the PTA. This would be about 35 or so that you...
Yeah, 35, yes. Just before the blood thing in Soviet Union, before the trials. Because the trials, I think, were 36
right.
And 37.
Okay, well, then let's deal with the trials, then, because here the trials started, and right after the trials, you rejoined the party.
Yes, while the trials were going on in 36.
Now, how did you feel about the trials, and then about...
I just speak up. See, before, they said, look, you're not yet back in the party. If you want to have anything to say, you better rejoin the party, you see.
Oh, that's what they told, I see.
Now, and at that time, you'd be surprised, huh? The people who joined the party then, who afterward dropped out.
But
people from the colleges, people from the universities, really did.
But who joined?
The party.
At the time of the trial?
Well, before the trials.
Oh, who dropped out?
I don't think, yes, they dropped out.
When the trials began?
Yes, I think some of them dropped out when the trials began. But not enough of them really were critical of them. So strong had been the pressure on people not to be critical, not to question, that they didn't know all that was going on, and the thing was to ensure the safety, the security of the Soviet Union, because it was still surrounded by enemies all over, threatening to destroy the infant state. So strong had it been, that you almost felt like a traitor if you were tired saying anything.
Oh, I see. Now, the other day you said you were... So that even though you felt so strongly about the trials, you, on the other hand, felt that you couldn't attack them because it would help to destroy the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So what kinds of... When you would talk against them, would you find other people agreeing with you? Or not?
Yes, a few. Only a few. Most of them didn't. Most of them would say, you don't know all that's going on there. You don't know.
Mm.
One thing I knew that Trotsky and Zinoviev and Kamenev and Radek were not traitors.
Mm-hmm.
I knew they had not gone to betray because the lies that they told about them was fantastic. That Trotsky had gone to meet with the Hitlerite. Now, you know that wasn't so. There was an awful lot of lies that were told about it. But you see, they made it. I could understand how about the Catholics, you know. I once said to them, you know, if the Catholics were running the Communist Party, they couldn't do a better job of it because we certainly have adopted their methods. you know. He said, you know, Barbara, it's one thing to be fighting for anything. It's another thing to be a rebel about everything.
Oh, so you were just dismissed as being a rebel.
Yes. Yeah. A rebel in the wrong cause.
But why were you tolerated then? I mean, so many other people were.
Because I don't know why. No one ever threatened to really. Yeah, I don't know why. Because whenever they wanted, you know, surely you don't know how many parties were given to celebrate the birthday. But, you know, not because I was important. Because I was the best known of all of them, so that they could raise more money on account of it. The biggest one that they ever had was This Is Your Life, taking it from that guy who was, but I never read him. I didn't know anything at all about it. I didn't know what they were talking about, you know, This Is Your Life. And that one, I was 69, almost 70, but it was supposed to be celebrating my 70th birthday. And two of the that I knew that were musicians, one of them wrote, how young can you be how many years, but he put it poetically and everything. I could never remember, and I said, oh, it's really not that poetic. It really isn't. But anyway, and they filled the big hall, you know, just overflowing, because I was the best man. For years and years, our home had been a kind of, whether it was in Berkeley or in Los Angeles, our home had been a kind of our headquarters for. I don't know why, Sherna, but it was true.
Mm-hmm.
So that both in Berkeley or Oakland or Los Angeles, it was true.
So there was a reluctance, partially because of your age and how long you had been involved, to really criticize you, do you think?
Well, you see, when I did, see, it's like Bill Taylor. I don't know if you ever met him.
I think so.
No, he doesn't know very much, you know. Every time he speaks, he tells you about slavery, you know, and everything. But he said, when he was one of the speakers of the night, he said, well, you know, our Barbie, you can't tell, you know, she's a stormy petrel, and when she doesn't agree with you, she tells you no answer, because she doesn't, and nobody can do anything, but she's still our Barbie, you see. And, but never